Welcome to Business Trip, a podcast exploring the future of mental health and wellness. I'm Matthias Serbrinski, and I'm a partner at Simon Ventures, a fund invested in psychedelic medicine and mental health. This episode is a special one. Bram Rector, general partner at Empath Ventures, joins me to interview Jacob Robinson, the CEO and founder of Motif Neurotech. Jacob is an entrepreneurial scientist. He transitioned from professor to founder, and he leveraged his research on neuromodulation to start Motif. What's neuromodulation, you're asking? Well, it's the process of regulating activity in the nervous system through electrical, chemical, or mechanical stimulation. Motif develops minimally invasive brain implants that stimulate specific regions of the brain to treat depression and other mental health conditions. They do this without any invasive surgery or pharmaceuticals. In this episode, we explore Motif's technology, the future of the neurotech market, and how Jacob tapped his academic network to recruit exceptional talent. We also discuss his perspective on the challenges and opportunities of transitioning from professor to founder. To the episode, we go. Welcome to the show. This is an exciting one because we're chatting with Jacob, but also it's an unusual one and special because a friend of the house, Bram Rector, is also on the pod. So I was excited about having this episode with him and exploring a different way of having conversations with smart founders.
I'm excited to be here too. And I'm the outlier, right? I'm with a couple of pro podcasters, so I'm in for a treat.
Well, your beginner mind may be more useful than our supposedly pro mind. But yeah, Jacob, let's start with the bigger picture of neuromodulation. What's the case for neuromodulation? Why does this exist? Why, in some cases, maybe better than pharmacological interventions, aka drugs?
I think a better way of thinking about it is a tool in the toolbox that people can use to help people with neurological and mental health condition. And it's a different type of tool than drugs. And that's probably why it exists. It exists because it can target a specific part of the brain in ways that drugs struggle. Now, drugs, as you guys know and talk about a lot on your podcast, go after receptors, right? So particular type molecules that are expressed at the surface of cells. And that's one way to be very specific, right? I can go after those particular receptors. But with neuromodulation, we can go after a particular area. So one spot, even though those receptors might be expressed throughout the brain and throughout the body, we can control where we are affecting activity at a specific region of the brain. And this turns out to be extremely therapeutic for conditions like major depressive disorder, OCD, and we're learning more and more that we can target conditions like PTSD, ADHD, Alzheimer's disease by manipulating the activity with specific temporal resolution. Like we can turn it on, we can turn it off. And that turns out to be a different mode of therapy than you can get with drugs that are usually longer lasting and have broader effects.
From a mechanistic understanding of how neuromodulation works, is it similar or different? When I think of drugs, they're out-regulating, down-regulating different receptors. When I think of at least certain neuromodulation techniques, it's almost like they're retraining circuits in the brain, right? Like there's the way that they work, it seems to be very different, almost like, you know, somewhere in between drugs and therapy.
Yeah, I think that's probably a good way of thinking about it as being in between drugs and therapy. And I would describe broadly what the field thinks about in terms of neuromodulation, at least my understanding of the perspective. And that is that with neuromodulation, you can affect areas of the brain in a few different ways. One way is to make that area more active or more excitable so that when it receives input, it responds to that input. An example of this could be the theory behind neuromodulation for major depressive disorder is that in the prefrontal cortex, the part of the brain associated with executive function, it's a little bit underactive. You know, you need to be motivating yourself to do things. And it's that region of the brain isn't as active as it needs to be. But if I stimulate that brain with the right pattern of electrical stimulation, and the next time it receives an input, it responds to that input. So you're making that part more excitable. The other way it could work is it can make that part of the brain less excitable by changing the frequency from a high frequency stimulation to a low frequency stimulation. And in some ways, you might be able to block activity altogether with even higher frequencies. So we think of this as almost like a gain that you can apply to specific regions of the brain. And that gain is implemented via a plasticity that occurs at the cells and the connections between the cells.
So if that's the case and there is a clear benefit of this, why is this market so much smaller than pharmacological interventions or drugs?
One reason is it's hard to administer and it's hard to distribute, right? So like once you come up with like your small molecule, you're like, cool, we're going to put in a pill. I'm going to ship to everybody. You pop it in your mouth and we can immediately distribute to a large number of people. When we think about neuromodulation, we need some way to deliver energy to a focal part of the brain. That is not distributed by a pill. That's distributed by a device. So devices are expensive. They need some kind of targeting. You need like a professional to align it to a right spot. And if it's not implanted, you have to figure out how to align it every day. If it's implanted, that's a little bit easier, but then you need a surgeon. So there's this whole infrastructure in terms of distribution and costs that makes it harder to disseminate. I think the second challenge is social acceptance and adoption. So if you think about the history, devices, and other aspects of human health, you think of like cardiac pacemakers. So blood pressure medication, easy to distribute, commonly used, highly prescribed. But at some point, you need a more effective or direct intervention, like a pacemaker. But that's taken decades really to receive the kind of widespread adoption. When it was first brought out, people were like, oh crap, you're going to put like do heart surgery or put something in my heart. That seems like super scary. And it took a while for people to get comfortable with this idea that this is an important life-saving measure. It's a super effective therapy. You're going to live better. You're going to live longer. And it became the standard of care. And now people, I think, don't react in the same way when someone is working at a pacemaker and they're like, okay, that's what we need to do. We haven't reached that point in the sense of neuromodulation where people think I'm suffering a major depressive episode. It's time for me to do neuromodulation to get better. At some point, maybe we get there. But right now, socially, I don't think we're there yet.
Well, modulation's been around for a long time, though, right? It's just the implantable modulation is newer. Like, when was TMS invented? It was like the 80s, 70s?
Transcranial magnetic stimulation, or TMS, is a non-invasive brain stimulation technique that uses magnetic fields to induce electrical currents in parts of the brain. It's used to treat mental health conditions like depression.
Yeah, and it's been FDA approved, I think, since 2003. So it's been out there. And there's lots of forms of neuromodulation. I'd actually argue that neuromodulation predates all of that. It actually started with lesioning. So if you think about like frontal lobotomies, right, that was kind of the beginning of when people started thinking about neuromodulation. And at some point, they're like, oh, we can make an electronic lesion by stimulating that part of the tissue. And it turned out that it actually worked. So there's this transition from lesioning to modulation, which was decades ago. But both implantable as well as non-invasive, they both struggle from distribution challenges. There's still not a lot of great clinical evidence behind it. So I think it's a long road for it to get adoption.
Got, and the clinical stuff, you have to go, what, every day for a long period of time?
Yeah. So TMS, for example, that's a logistical barrier. Another way to think about it is for drugs, it's relatively easy to take a pill every day, right? For most of these therapies, maybe other than psilocybin, you need a consistent course of drug therapy. The same is true for neuromodulation. You need a consistent course of stimulation, otherwise the effects wear off over time. And so if I'm thinking about something like TMS, where it's a big machine that sits in a clinic somewhere, I have to go to that clinic regularly. 5 days a week for 6 weeks is an FDA-approved course. And then typically patients need to come back at 11 months on average after those effects wear off. So you need to keep this therapy going. And that becomes part of that distribution challenge. It's like, how do I get that therapeutic neuromodulation on a regular basis into my lifestyle?
Yeah, 5 days a week for 6 weeks sounds pretty tough, even for someone that's not functionally impaired due to severe depression.
Yeah, even with things that show large efficacy for certain conditions or disorders, you need to solve for market needs or market constraints. And so that is what we're facing with many of these revolutionary or novel technologies, where it's not enough that they work. They need to be friendly or accommodate to both a existing healthcare infrastructure and also the patient journey and the patient needs. I have a suspicion that you're doing a couple of things to help with that part as well.
I think you raise a couple of interesting points here. We've been thinking about, you know, neuromodulation and technologies to help with mental health disorders and looking a lot at treatment-resistant depression. And what people often report is efficacy numbers, right? And so we look at literature like, wow, there's some stuff that like looks really good when you look at efficacy. Why hasn't this caught on more? TMS is an example of this. TMS has actually great efficacy numbers compared to a lot of pharmacological intervention, but it hasn't penetrated the market in the way that people had hoped. And that, I think, is because efficacy is only part of the story, right? But you also have to think about durability and tolerability. And then you have to have the business case that you mentioned, Mattia. So what's often not reported is durability. So that means, okay, if I go through my course of therapy, how long am I better? In the case of TMS, median relapse time is 11 months. So you can have 60% response rates. If you look at some of the accelerated TMS therapies coming out of Stanford, 80 or 90% response rate. But then if you look at how long that lasts, it could be only a few months. And so it's the efficacy and durability together that tell that story. And then if you look at pharmacological inventions, I think there's a tolerability component, which is like, what are the side effect profile? Because oftentimes people fall off their medications, not because they don't work, but because the side effects reach levels of intolerability. Antidepressants, as you know, sexual dysfunction, metabolic distress, weight gain. Those kinds of things is really what stand in the way of people getting the treatment that they need. So this is a complex picture in terms of the target product profile that you really need, and then getting it reimbursed, getting it distributed, finding a way to give it to people in a way that fits their lifestyle. All those other constraints have to fit in. And you also have institutional momentum in terms of the psychiatric practices, like what are psychs used to doing? How are they used to interact with patients? What are these prescribing? You start to tell them to like change their practice. You're really fighting an uphill battle.
Okay, so maybe it's time to explain a little bit more what Motif is and why, in that sense, it's different and what is solving around these problems.
Maybe a little bit about my background. So been in neurotech for a little over a decade. I got trained in physics. So I was like really, in some ways, actually probably by design, I retreated from all of the stuff going on in the mental space. It seemed like not tractable, like it didn't make sense, really complicated. At some point, following my PhD training, I thought maybe it was time where we could take some kind of data-driven, hard science approaches toward mental health, even though it seemed like a really scary and intractable space. Some of the work that I had seen coming out of neuromodulation, this was really an approach to solving mental health problems at a circuit level. So thinking about systems and circuit, how I might be able to manipulate those systems and circuits with technology to affect human health and the human condition. That seemed super exciting. So I started a career in academia at Rice in 2012 to build neurotechnologies to stimulate and record brain activity with the hope that we could get a handle on those neural circuits in ways that you cannot get with drugs for the reasons that I mentioned in terms of lack of specificity. So one of the things that I was really curious about is how can we make this technology minimally invasive? I was thinking about if what we are trying to do is create alternatives or augmentation to drugs, we want patients to be able to approach neuromodulation technology without it seeming too scary, right? And for that to work, we thought, okay, we need something like really tiny, minimally invasive. It should be like a LASIK procedure, should be the in and out bang, in some ways less invasive than a cardiac pacemaker. And so we spent about 10 years in my lab at Rice working on miniaturizing technologies, came up with the platform to deliver energy that allowed us to miniaturize stuff. So finally could be made so small that it could be a 20-minute outpatient procedure. And then that was when I really felt like we had this like unique opportunity where there's a science had been advancing. We had seen really great work from TMS, accelerated TMS, deep brain stimulation, other forms of neuromodulation is really starting to make a ton of progress in the mental health space. And we had, over the last 10 years, working on solving that delivery problem of how do we miniaturize a device and make it outpatient. We thought now is the right time for us to marry those two things. The only way to do that for an implantable device is to go out, start a commercial venture and raise $100+ million. And that wasn't going to happen in my lab. So I took a leap of absence and started Motif with the goal of being able to create this brain-computer interface for mental health states, starting with treatment-resistant depression.
Well, Brom and myself with Simon Ventures and Brom with Empath Ventures are investors in Motif. And so, Brom, I'm curious if you can share more about what initially got you excited about Motif and maybe what's changed about your assessment of the company now.
Yeah, we're making up a tiny fraction of that $100 million that you need to raise eventually. So glad to be like one tiny grain of sand on the ocean of cash that you need to rake in. And I'm very appreciative to you, Matthias, and Greg at SciMed for introducing me to Motif in the first place. Probably would not have come across them without you guys. So very grateful for our friendship and collaboration. In terms of what got me excited about it, my fund has largely been focused on psychedelic medicine. And this was the first time I'd ever really looked at some sort of medical device. So it was very new to me, but I was very familiar with the concept of TMS. It's something that's commonly talked about in conjunction with ketamine and other psychedelic therapies. I did know that the big problem was this adherence because you have to go into a clinic multiple times a week for a long time for it to work. And I had also heard that a lot of the consumer grade, like headband stuff that you can buy on Amazon doesn't really work. It's mostly gimmicky. I knew a few people that had bought those and hadn't had good experiences. And when you just read the literature, there's not much evidence of those things working. And so I was intrigued by this idea of something that was implantable, that was leveraging this sort of, I think you touched on it, Jacob, but some sort of like wireless power technology breakthrough that allowed you to deliver this like clinical grade power in some sort of at-home format. It made a lot of sense. It was so sort of bold saying, we're going to drill a tiny little hole in your head to deliver this thing. It was the kind of thing that a lot of people have this, you know, instinctive reaction to, just like they do with psychedelics, which to me from an investor means that there's like an opportunity there because a lot of people are just going to ignore it based on whatever preconceived notions they have about the subject. They're not going to take the time to go deeper. And so I liked that it had this kind of crazy, we're going to give you psychedelics or we're going to like put this thing in your skull. I like the boldness of it. And then talking to Jacob, getting into the data room, seeing the level of detail and level of organization and thought that had gone into putting that data room together, which I thought was far more advanced than what we usually see in like a pre-seed data room. It's very impressive. And we also started talking to people that knew a lot more about brain stimulation than us. So I won't say who, but we talked to someone that does a lot of work at brain stimulation at Stanford. And I also talked to someone who had started a consumer grade TMS company and just asked what they thought. And they all seemed to think it was an interesting idea. And then I also, one of my mentors in VC always told me, you can't do the deal until you talk to the competition. So I tried to find other people that were working on similar projects, and there aren't a ton, that's for sure. It's a very small universe. But talked to one or two of those folks and felt that the angle that you were approaching it with made a little bit more sense to me. And so decided to move forward. And since then, which I guess that was December of last year, it's been like 8 months. I think it's just been really cool to see the speed at which you're executing. The regular communication is greatly appreciated. It's funny, a lot of times people say that academics don't make good founders, but as far as I can tell, you're doing a top decile job.
You touched on a couple of things that also got us excited. I want to go back to this idea of TMS and rapid TMS working for somewhere between 80 and 90%. So if we think of psychedelics, which is a sector that our audiences are very familiar with, MAPS reported 67% remission rates and something like 89% of the participants in the clinical trials showing improvements. And people were losing their minds, right? This does not exist in psychiatry, right? And this was for PTSD, a different indication. But my point is that we have another alternative that has these wild efficacy percentages that are just unheard of in in psychiatry and mental health, and you touched on SSRIs and antidepressants, and I'm with you in the sense of there's nothing to demonize about them, and they work for certain people. But you see the numbers, and number one, they're not even close to these percentages. And number two, it takes a lot of cycling through different medications in order to maybe get there with all these side effects. In that sense, the fact that we're talking about something that is this effective is unheard of in psychiatry to a big degree. At the same time, that is where the comparisons with TMS, for example, stop, right? You have a mechanistic understanding of how this could work. But then when you go to the other points you mentioned before, administration, adherence, adoption, all these things are widely different. And so that was the part that was, oh, wow, this is very different on how you're doing it. And I think the part that it's usually not discussed is the materials engineering breakthrough technology here, which is like more under the hoods and maybe harder to explain, but this is quite unique. And that is where this goes from just biotech material to crossover deep tech material as a company. There's something there around materials engineering that is really unique. So I'm curious, Jacob, if you can talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, when we were thinking about what would be the neurotechnology that could really make an impact in the marketplace and for patients, it came down to this idea of minimal invasiveness, right? Brahm said it's like crazy, this brain implant thing, not brain implant, skull implant. And that was an important thing. Look, brain surgery is a heavy lift for people. Right. You have to have a certain severity and level of desperation to say, okay, I'm going to let you put something inside my brain. There's money out there for these kinds of things. And that's their whole thesis, right? Is we're going to put things inside your brain. And if you look at adoption, people accept devices that penetrate the brain at a rate of about 10% or so, if you look at severe Parkinson's disease. And that's a very debilitating disorder. And if we wanted to think about how could we expand that, right? How could we be like something that could be effective or reach a population at 30% adoption rate? Then we thought, well, what if we didn't touch the brain at all? What if I had a way to stimulate the brain with a level of precision that you would get with an implant or a TMS, but we could implant that surgically above the brain without ever making contact? And that changes the whole risk profile. So that when the doctor presents this to you, the adverse events, it looks like scalp infection. It doesn't look like brain hemorrhage or damage. So that was the thesis. And so we spent about 10 years looking at different modalities and came up with this cool material called magnetoelectrics that gives us high energy densities that could be delivered wirelessly and safely. Part of the catalyst that caused me to take a leave of absence from Rice and start the company was the fact that now thinking about the opportunity landscape, when you think about psychedelics, you have some kind of moat that allows you to patent your drug. And that means that other people can't sell that same drug, right? In med device, you need to create a moat also. But if you're just building out of the same components that everybody else has access to, that moat is pretty shallow. And the fact that we had this wireless power delivery technology meant we actually had a technical moat. We had something that we could patent. And we could say, no one else can use this technology for wireless power. And thus, no one can make a device as small as we can make it. And that gave us the defensibility that we felt like we could run with in the same way like a drug company could run with, like a pretty highly defensible product. And the fact that we could miniaturize it to the point that we could fit within the thickness of the skull means that then the surgical procedure looks like you go in, you can go under heavy sedation, you go under general anesthesia if you wanted to, and in about 20 minutes, we drop this thing in into the skull, suture the skin back up, and you go home that day. And so then it starts to look a lot more like a LASIK procedure that can be done in any ambulatory outpatient surgical facility versus something that you have to get admitted into the hospital for. So it really changes the distribution model. And that was a real, so it's not just adoption, it's adoption and distribution with the technical moat. And those things came together because we had the wireless power transfer technology.
I have just more technical questions about the whole thing because I think it's really fascinating. You started at the beginning of the conversation talking about how there are these specific regions in the brain where this stuff happens. How do you figure out where to actually put the implant? Because that's going to vary per person, right?
Yeah. So this is in the story for drugs, it's often oversimplification. People are like, oh, buy this receptor and blah, blah, blah. It's a story that we tell and it's mostly true, but there's probably other things happening. Same thing is for neuromodulation. It's, oh, there's a region of the brain that we stimulate and it becomes more active. Therefore, you have better executive functioning. Probably mostly true. If I want to go a little bit deeper, it's a network. And one node of that network happens to be in one region of the brain. But it's actually multiple regions of the brain that engage in this network. And so you could probably interface to multiple different places. We just happen to know where one of those nodes is that tends to be effective. And we know that from a couple of sources. One is if you look at functional brain imaging and you compare people with depression and people without depression, you can see a spot in that brain which shows less activity. And it's roughly in the same spot on everybody. I would argue you don't necessarily need to have personalized targeting in order to be effective. And we also know that because TMS does not incorporate personalized targeting. Method of targeting works well for maybe 60% of the people, but the 40% of people that don't respond, it might be a targeting problem, but we just don't know it yet. And so I think when I think about the evolution of neuromodulation, it's going to start with gross rules for how we target for everybody. But as we get more personalized targeting, you'll start to see efficacy numbers creep up because now we're adjusting for Brahms' area of the dorsal lateral prefrontal cortex, which might be a little bit different than the TS's area of the dorsal lateral prefrontal cortex.
In the cyberpunk future that we're all going to live in, according to Elon Musk and ever the smart person, will this stuff become more widely available for less super serious conditions? Might it also even eventually be used for just like general human upgrade, performance enhancement type stuff? What do you think?
And so as that dial switches, it switches not just because of the severity of the indication, right? Going from like suicidal ideation to just general major depressive disorder, but it also changes the types of mental health conditions that people might consider. Like at some point it becomes ADHD, right? And the story isn't that, oh, I'm going to go get an implant for ADHD. The story becomes, I want to get better. I want to be able to choose when I focus on my tasks. I want to be able to do that at the push of a button, and I don't want to have side effects that I get with amphetamine. And when that becomes the case, then you're talking about a very fine line between being able to choose to focus because it's therapeutic versus choosing to be able to focus because it's human augmentation. All right, if I wanted to switch into a hyper-focused state at a push of a button, for someone with ADHD, it's therapeutic. For someone that's neurotypical, that becomes augmentation. So it is a gradient till we get there.
And obviously we see this with Adderall and everything.
Exactly.
What do we know about people using TMS and other neurostimulation when they maybe don't have some sort of psychiatric indication, or maybe they just double the dose of regular TMS?
Yeah. So it's interesting because TMS is difficult to access. So it's not like drugs in the sense that someone can just walk into a TMS clinic and say, I want to get like 10x the TMS dose. Fire it up. Let's go. It's still a prescription procedure, right? And so there's a psychiatrist intermediary that's gatekeeping any of this stuff. So we don't know a lot about what would happen if people had access to neuromodulation recreationally. Now, what we do know is that if we basically condense TMS, so if you take that 6-week course that we talked about, we squeeze it into 3 weeks by going twice a day, or we squeeze it into 2 weeks by going 3 times a day, you see the effects faster and you tend to see more responders. So it's almost as though what is the critical parameter is the dose. It's like, how many stimulation pulses am I getting? And if I can squeeze that into a shorter period of time, I can get better faster.
We see that with some of the studies on psilocybin. The higher the dose, the longer the therapeutic effect lasts.
But the interesting thing about TMS is it's the opposite. So as I start to increase the dose, you get better faster, but you also get worse faster.
Ah, so there's a rebound. Okay. Interesting.
Let's go back to the superhuman part. I'm curious if you have a case for why it wouldn't work in healthy individuals.
No, I would actually, on the other side, I don't see why it wouldn't work in healthy individuals. What we're talking about is modulating the excitability of a different part of the brain associated with executive function. Then in healthy individuals, I would expect to improve executive function ability. If it's a part of the brain associated with attention, I would similarly expect to see improved attention. And we see this a little bit also in, there is some data on TMS looking at improvements in working memory. So if you do things like these NBAC tests, which is like how many of the last N things can you remember? With neuromodulation, healthy individuals can remember more of those things in that list if they receive neuromodulation as those lists are being presented. So I think there is this early evidence suggesting that in healthy individuals, neuromodulation to affect attention and working memory will likely be effective for them in, quote unquote, enhancing.
I cannot avoid thinking of the ethical implications of all this. And in most of the things that we are investing in and involved, there's a huge component of that. And the negative side of it is that this is not science, right? And so there are no binary answers, and there's no kind of like ground truth on how to go about it. So how do you think of the ethical implications of this and maybe the guardrails that go around thinking and developing devices and technologies like this one?
There's a lot to unpack there. A couple of things I want to short circuit, which is there's sometimes the bias. You guys probably don't have this, but sometimes I get this where I'm like, oh, hey, there's these like cool implants that are going to help people with mental health conditions, help people focus, help people achieve executive function, maybe could lead to enhancement. And people are like, whoa, stop. Like, we should just stop these technologies. It's unethical. Or it could be unethical if it were put into the wrong hands. And I think that impetus is unfounded because there is an obligation, I think, that we have as founders, technology developers, and investors to help bring therapies to market that are going to help people. And in case of major depressive disorder, or TRD, it's going to save people's lives. So we can't not develop technologies that are going to save lives. That, I would argue, is unethical. So, but what we can do is try to anticipate how might it be misused so that by the time technologies like these are widely available, there are some guardrails. And so then at least that changes the conversation. So it's not a conversation of should we or shouldn't we make neurotech. The conversation is, how do we make neurotech most responsibly? And so in that vein, I think there's a lot of opinions. I think we can think of all the dystopian versions of this and like how we can end up with a world where like wealthy people can have enhanced memory and poor people don't have that. The only way to get a job at a company is if you get a, the advantage that we have is that development timelines are relatively long. So we have some time to put those guardrails in place now before the technology is available, which maybe we didn't have for things like social media. Like, we totally screwed that up, right? We can anticipate what might go wrong now, put those guardrails in, and those guardrails are going to be regulatory guardrails, most likely. And fortunately for class three implantables, like the technology we're talking about, it's regulated by the FDA. So you have to go through FDA, already handle a lot of these things with drugs, right? You could argue that Adderall is a great example, right? Adderall could be thought of as like a performance enhancing drug. And so in many ways, the way that we handle these drugs that can be abused, I think is how we're going to handle neurotechnology that could also be abused. So I feel that that's probably the way to think about it. Think about it like a drug that's therapeutic but could also be used or abused.
And what do you think maybe some of the follow-on applications could be?
Yeah, the most evidence is treatment-resistant depression. And that's why we started there. Like I mentioned a little bit, my background is physics. So the first thing I did was like, okay, what has the most data? Because I don't want to be solving a neuroscience problem. I'm already solving a pretty hard tech problem. Where can we go and be really confident that there's a lot of clinical data behind neuromodulation being an effective therapy? And that's in TRD. Decades of work. TMS is FDA approved. We have a lot of understanding about the mechanism of action. So that was why we picked that starting point. The other reason, which was secondary, is that it's unfortunately an enormous market. So there's about 2.8 million Americans with treatment-resistant depression every single year. That's incidence, not prevalence. And then we also know that roughly 100,000 people a year are going through electroconvulsive therapy. About 30,000 people a year are going through TMS. So it's just a lot of people that need help and at an extreme level of desperation. and it's the most clinically sound. So those two things seem like that's why it's a starting point. Where we go next is also probably going to be informed by TMS. The benefit that TMS has compared to implantables is that there's a low barrier to doing a little bit, right? So if someone want to run a clinical trial and you have to go in for 5 days, sure, sign me up for that, for a PTSD trial or Alzheimer's disease trial, ADHD trial. And then that clinical data is going to build over time. And then it's going to reach that level of maturity that TRD is today. And that's when I think we begin to approach those with implantable neuromodulation. And where I see the best data coming out next is probably in PTSD or Alzheimer's disease. There's some really good TMS data coming out for both of those indications. That's probably where we'll end up going next.
Alzheimer's would be huge.
This idea, Jacob, of building on top of the findings we have with TMS, it reminds me in the drug market of the first in class and best in class. And many times in psychedelics, also we call them psychedelics in some other places, next generation. So the idea that there's something that's first market is great because all of a sudden we know that something works, but then there's a lot of things that can be improved. So that's like how I think of these minimally implantable devices many times.
Yeah, there's also something that I come kind of from the physics of electrical engineering background. And one thing I saw when I was looking at the literature is that the number of clinical trials for TMS is growing exponentially with a doubling rate of about every 2.5 years. And what that means is that the clinical evidence behind neuromodulation is growing at an exponential rate, like a Moore's law for neuromodulation science. And in fact, the doubling time is almost the same as Moore's law. So it's wow, like, we're starting today with this wealth of information about how neuromodulation helps for TRD. In the next 10 years, the next 2 years, it's going to double. It's going to double again after that. It's going to double again after that. And so all this clinical evidence is going to build up behind it. So you don't just have this first class, best in class, but you also just have this compounding body of literature behind it.
Is this making you more bullish on the category, Brahm?
I'm very bullish. I love anything with a fast doubling rate. It's very exciting. I got to find some more stimulative investments. It's hard. I like to try to only back the best in class. So it'll be tough to find anyone comparable to Motif. I think one thing that might be good for you to talk about real quick is just like the varieties of different implants. I think maybe to the layperson, they might be thinking, why would anyone get the Motif implant when I can just get the Neuralink implant and then download the TMS app and like play the TMS program on my Neuralink? Like, is that how it works, or are all of these implants very specifically designed for a specific thing? And which one is sort of the most general use case?
Yeah, that's, I think, a really interesting point. The Neuralink implant and the Motif implant are very different. The Neuralink implant is optimized to try to get, it's mainly a recording device. So it's optimized to try to get as much information as it can from one area of the brain. So think of it as an Ethernet link to your motor cortex. And the primary application is like an output device. Like, can I like think text messages and transmit them directly to Brahm's Neuralink, and it's going to send him like my text message into his visual cortex and it's going to pop up on his eyeball. Now, that's the application space. Or I'm going to connect to ChatGPT and I'm going to be able to like compose coherent sentences. And if that's the application that you're thinking about, go and get your Neuralink. Now, the application that we're thinking about is what is going to allow me to control my mental state? What's going to help me feel more focused? What's going to help with my memory? What's going to help with my mood? In that case, it's not actually a lot of data that we're transmitting. Like your affect, the way you feel, is encoded in not a tremendous amount of information. So I just need to be able to stimulate, to change the activity in my brain, this larger scale way. And what we haven't seen through companies like Neuralink or Synchron or Paradromics or these other neurotech companies, we have not seen stimulation. Stimulation is really hard. It's hard to do well. It's hard to do over long periods of time. And that's what we're really focused on. So when these platforms come to market, I think you're going to see a class of technologies that are like my data link, and those will be Neuralink, Synchron, Paradromics, Precision, some of these other companies. And those are going to be a class of devices, which is like, what is my state regulator? What's the thing that's going to help me change mood, memory, attention, focus? And those two things can actually live in parallel. Like I could be able to text you with my Neuralink thing. And at the same time, before I go to bed, I want to like wind down and turn my motif on to try to like calm myself.
Interesting. Interesting. So there's different use cases for different ones. Maybe eventually there'll be some tech that can do it all, but it sounds like for now they're going to be segregated. What do you think, Matthias, though? Because you've done a lot more investing in BCIs and brain stuff than I have. How do you see the landscape? Do you think it's going to be absolutely massive? Like to what extent do you think the stuff is useful? And when are you getting an implant?
I'm obviously very bullish on the market. There's a lot of early indicators of future success. You have a bunch of companies that have minimally invasive devices treating very kind of uncorrelated conditions like pain, bladder control, migraines. There are certain neuromodulation devices that are being used mostly off-label for migraines as well. And these are companies that are public and have valuations somewhere between $2 billion and $10 billion. And so I truly think that there's these things that are already happening in areas that are not psychiatric areas that are proven to be super successful. And as Jacob mentioned, like number of clinical trials and products and companies that are coming to market with things like this is growing. So obviously I'm very interested in this. And the other part that I resonate with is this idea of energy as the thing that you're doing. And it's so interesting that this thing that is so woo-woo, like energy, is so like grounded in science. And Jacob can talk a lot more about energy, but ultimately it's about energy. So switching gears a little bit, as I talk to folks that are not involved with Motif, meaning they're not investors or they're not employees, the first thing they say is, holy cow, the quality of talent that is coming into Motif is absolutely mind-blowing. So I just want you to give us your secret, Jacob. How are you doing it? How are you winning over all these key employees? Help us bring great talent the way you do it.
I would like to chalk it up to my charm and good looks, but unfortunately, I think there's no secret sauce. I think what happened for us, which is very fortunate, is that because I've been in the academic space for so long, like I saw these things coming together. I saw really great neuroscience coming out or understanding mental health conditions as network level disorders. Like that's really going to unlock so many therapeutic opportunities. And at the same time, I saw the med device companies really struggling with legacy platforms. Basically, all their technology is built on like pacemakers that were developed in the 50s. They have a big Canon Elite. And I was like, what they really want to do is they want to miniaturize, and they're big and they can't innovate in the way that a small company can. And so I think it was really timing. So there's these like trends that are catching fire, like in psychiatry, like all the interventional psychiatrists we talk to are thinking about circuit level disorders and how can I manipulate the circuit and measure the circuit. And everybody on the tech side is like, how can I build a smaller, less invasive miniature thing? And we happen to have these two things together. And so when, you know, I've reached out to people in my network and talked about what we're building, they got super excited about it. So I think in some ways it's the timing of what we have, it's sold itself. And I think maybe the lessons, if you want to be more to generalize it, is that catching trends like early on is a great way for you to recruit talent. Because if it was just me, it's like, I'm the only person doing this, like there's no way we'd be able to recruit the talent. But it's not just me, it's the field and it's the leaders in the field that are moving in this direction. We just happen to catch the that wave.
That totally makes sense about how you're able to attract the talent to the startup. What else can you tell us about the transition from becoming a professor to becoming a startup founder? It's a very different type of thing that you have to do. Can you compare and contrast what those two roles have been like and how the transition's been for you?
Yeah, totally. It's been intense. I think maybe to dovetail on like the talent side of things, one thing that I had done in my lab, is maybe my philosophy is that you reach a certain point in a lab and you become an advisor and you're trying to mentor people through a process. And when you reach that point, the way that your lab is successful is by getting the best talent in. You're looking at like really smart people and give them like space and resources. They're going to do awesome stuff. And that's also the approach that I've taken to the company that may have helped us recruit talent as well. Because my approach isn't come to Motif, I'm going to tell you what to do. Come to Motif because you're really smart. You're going to fill out figure out some cool stuff. And we're going to make a space that's going to allow you to make the best technology possible and bring that to life. And I think that resonates with, I think, really like a lot of high performers. And so that like approach that I had in academia really translated, I think, to building a company, at least building the company that we're doing. Similarly, my role in my lab had been a lot about providing those resources, right? Can I get money in? Can I tell the story about what we're doing in a way that is going to attract funders and new talent? And that's also the role of the founder. I feel like where it's like really different is my personal level of security. So I have a tenured position. I could literally come in theory, I could come in like one day a week and do nothing and like have a job for life. That lets one sleep well at night. Yeah, as a founder, you don't have that, right? You have to go out into an uncertain market and hope that you're going to raise the next round before you run out of money, which could happen, I don't know, in some number of months. I'm not used to thinking about like how we're going to execute in the next several months in order to stay alive. Like that level of like stress and anxiety is foreign to my experience as an academician. That's been, I think, the biggest struggle. But the me aspect of it, the leadership, like trying to put together like a team that executes that, that part comes, I think, more naturally than I had expected.
That makes sense. If only there was some sort of minimally invasive electronic solution to manage that stress and anxiety, that would be nice.
One day.
And how has fundraising been in particular? There is fundraising that you have to do in the academic world, but it's a different type of funder. You're not trying to convince someone that they're going to make a big return on their investment, right? Which in some ways is probably harder, but in some ways is maybe easier too, because they just assume that the money's going to be spent and they're never going to see it again. Whereas here, you have to present a business case. Like what's been talking to VCs like? And have there been any things that maybe surprised you when talking to VCs and relative to how you thought it would be when you were about to embark on this journey?
So many things. So I'll give you the classic case of it happening too. It's like, a VC called me and like, they're interested in my thing. And so I'm going to give a lot of money to start a company. And I feel like that's the academic response. It's, oh, someone expressed interest. I had one conversation and then I just have another conversation. They're going to write a check. And that is so far from the truth, right? At least that's been far from the truth in my case. Checks don't come often after a single conversation. I think that like the level of kind of back and forth and relationship building that goes into entering into a partnership with the VC is not what I expected. I expected to be more transactional. I'm going to give you a proposal. This is my business proposal. You're going to evaluate. You're going to say yes or no, and then you're going to give me money. And that's been so far so different from what I've experienced. And that is more of it's a relationship building. It's been described to me as dating. It's like you go on a couple of dates, and then eventually you decide to get married, but it doesn't happen all at once. So that's been like a big shift. I would say the other big shift has been like handling rejection is way harder in the VC world than it is in academia. Because in academia, I write a grant and I'll like send it off to the federal government. And then months later, I'm going to get a yes or no on written down on paper. And there's going to be this whole rationale. When you pitch to like a VC, when I pitch to DC and we have a conversation, I look them in the eyes and I feel like we get along. And then I get an email or I just get ghosted. Then it's, they didn't like me. It's like a judgment on your character. It hits a lot harder than they didn't like my written proposal. And that took a lot of getting used to, because I have to develop a thicker skin.
Yeah, it's challenging. It feels like they're calling your baby ugly. This is exactly what Matthias and I deal with when we're raising money for our funds too. It's like the same kind of dynamic. It's tough, especially in the economic environment that we're currently in.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's been another challenge too. As a first-time founder coming out now, I guess times have been better. I haven't known them, so maybe I'm not spoiled. But at the same time, I feel like we're entering a rocky environment. So that's been something to navigate as well.
That's good. Like hard times create strong men or whatever.
So. Hope so.
The other theme that we're touching here, and this is more like my personal interest and like not so selfish interest, is I want to see a lot more academics moving to startup land and starting companies. The world needs a lot more people to start companies. And here's a secret, and maybe you can talk about this as well, Jacob. Learning business, it's a lot easier than learning physics. And learning bioengineering and things like that. So the time that you don't need to go through undergrad and grad school and become a PhD in order to start a company. It's hard in a lot of the different ways that you mentioned, and you're facing rejection all the time, and there are all these things that you cannot control at all that play a role in your success or failure. But ultimately, it can be learned. And the idea of entrepreneurial science, I think entrepreneurial science is one of the things that will save the world. So I just want to push a lot more people to, researchers, investigators, to think about this path as a way to have an outsized impact. Because ultimately, that is, I would argue, the biggest difference with academia, right? Like the speed at what you move here is much faster, and that results in much bigger outcomes and societal impact.
Yeah, absolutely. I would second that. I think the pitch that I would make to other people in the academy is that many of us got into science and engineering because we wanted to have a level of social impact. And there's a limit to what you can do with the resources that you have here. And the level of impact, the resources you're going to have outside of academia is almost unbounded. Neuralink can raise $280 million. Like, the money is out there for you to do something that's absolutely mind-blowing. And I think that opportunity is really exciting. And interestingly enough, it's also really aligned with investors. That's an unexpected bonus. It's like, I want to have this impact on society. And then I get to find like other people who are giving money. And then they join the journey, like you guys, right? Now you guys want to be successful too, right? And so now I have this whole team and we're all aligned on one thing, which is to make something that works and helps people. If that happens, everybody makes money and it's a winning partnership. So I feel like you have all of these people pulling for a singular goal. And in academia, I think it's a lot more individualistic.
That makes sense. Do you have any advice that you'd give to someone who's sitting there at their professorship in the academy, thinking about maybe starting a company, but not really sure? What's your words of wisdom after doing this for a year and a half or however long it's been?
It's been about a year and a half. I think having conversations with other people who've done it, they were really gracious with their time. There's this like weird community of founders. It's kind of like people bond over shared trauma, and starting a company is very traumatic. And so I feel like reaching out to these other like founders who've gone through that emotional distress of getting personally rejected, they want to help you. And so I feel like what my advice is that there's going to be a lot of like friendly founders. Ken at Alto is someone like this as well, who are there and they want to help you navigate this, because it is the hardest part is the emotional aspect of it. And I think we're all, having been through it, want to help make it easier for the people that come behind us.
That's a beautiful way to wrap up the interview. Jacob, thank you so much for your time. It's been such a pleasure to work with you and collaborate and see you grow as a leader, as a CEO, while still keeping the energy and the optimism. And even in the fundraising process, I checked in with you over text, and like the energy that we had in your responses was like, whoa, this guy's like full on, which is so hard to maintain. So I think that this combination of quality and speed is such an asset for Motif, and I'm looking forward to seeing where you go next.
Likewise, thank you so much for the support. It's always great chatting with you guys. And Matthias, one day we'll get you an implant, and then you can have energy and optimism whenever you want.
On demand. Bram, this was fun. Let's do it again.
Absolutely. Thank you, guys. Thanks for having me, Matthias. And it's great to be on board of the Motif rocket ship, Jacob. Thanks so much.
This is Business Trip, a podcast exploring the future of mental health and wellness. If you like this episode, you can help us by subscribing to the podcast and leaving a review. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at SciMed Ventures. And if you're building a company in frontier mental health, hit us up at hi@scimed.ventures, which you can find in the show notes. I'm Greg Kubin, and my co-host is Matthias Serebrinski. Caitlin Nur coordinates our podcast. Production and editorial assistance comes from Jonathan Davis. Sound design and engineering by Nico Ray. Our theme music is by Dorian Love, and additional music credits are in the show notes. This is Business Trip. Thanks for tripping with us. We'll see you next time.